I want the government to provide for my basic rights. I want the government to provide for my general safety and security. And okay, yeah, it's nice to have an EBT card and it's nice to have a free cell phone. But that's a special kind of slavery. That's a special kind of hell that the government imposed on a particular segment of our society, primarily the blacks. It's more economic, but predominantly it's the African Americans that have suffered from that. And I think if the unions, if the administration, Trump's reached out, not just, putting Carson in at Health and Social Services, but reaching out to community leaders within some of the major municipalities. You've got celebrities and sports figures and people who have leadership roles within the African American community to try to turn this thing around. There's so much racial divide. There's so much economic separation. You're listening to Jamie Williamson and Jim Warshak, also on America Out Loud. Jim Warshak is a retired Air Force colonel with 30 years in the intelligence community and political military affairs, and he has extensive combat tours in various commands in the U.S. and overseas, and is a recognized expert in intelligence and international affairs. Jim, welcome to the show.
Well, good afternoon, Jamie.
Thanks. I'm glad to have another fellow America Out Loud radio host on with me. And incidentally, Jim has been an integral part of the OPSEC organization almost from the inception. I'm glad to have you on board, Jim.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. A lot of things going on, and people are expecting a lot of new things as well as changes to kind of make up for, I guess you could say, 8 years of things somewhat of a miss.
Yeah, and I think we're going to see those changes. Rome wasn't built in a day. We're already off to a great start, I think, with a few hours in the Oval Office. So ask for patience and forbearance, and I think we're going to see a marked departure from some of what we've seen over the past 8 years. And our topic today is how to fix or repair our national security. And there's a lot of work to be done, wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. I think what people need to realize first and foremost is the Trump team and the growing and developing Trump administration certainly is off to a good start with those who have been certainly confirmed and those identified for his national security team from the standpoint of Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor, Secretary of Energy, and a number of other critical members of that team. I know you agree with me on that. I think a lot of
Absolutely.
Other people will too.
And I think with General Flynn as National Security Advisor, with his insight and experience and his own philosophies on what it takes to win this war, I think will be a tremendous asset to not just to Trump's cabinet, but to the nation as a whole and our security as a whole.
Yeah, that's definitely a given, and certainly he is an integral part. Certainly the National Security Advisor plays multiple roles as the arbiter between the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, as well as the person who is helping to guide the President's thoughts with regard to what direction he wants to take the country as it pertains to national security, defense, and foreign policy. And certainly he is the premier advisor to the president on those matters.
Yeah, and I think that Flynn has the view to look at national security from a holistic perspective, where so often, you know, we look at defense strictly as the intelligence community and Department of Defense, when in reality, you've got to incorporate Department of Energy, Department of Treasury. I mean, look at the vulnerability just by our national debt. It was Admiral Mullen, when Mullen was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and this was under the previous administration, he was asked what he perceived the largest threat to America's security to be. Without hesitation, he said our national debt.
Absolutely. And that's a misunderstanding a lot of people have when you hear the term national security. People tend to just put the military side and the foreign policy side. They don't automatically bring into perspective economics, finance, information, energy, so many other things that come to bear with regard to national security, because really, defense is not the only weapon we have in that quiver. You know, we have certainly national politics plays a role with regard to the mood of the nation. Diplomacy is a major factor, as those of us who have participated in this arena for many years understand. But finance and economics are actually really, in many ways, even more powerful than the military apparatus, because they reach across so many aspects of everything. And when you're dealing with, as we saw in World War II and the Cold War, we had to bring to bear every option we had availed to ourselves to play a critical part in that. And so I think as we go forward with regard to certainly radical Islam, it's going to be more than just a war of weapons, so to speak, as we've seen over the last 8 years, but it's going to be more of a war that includes all those other arrows in our quiver.
And that's an important point, Jim. And you and I both have backgrounds in asymmetric warfare. You know, half of the battle is on the information side, and how we as a nation are perceived and the message that we send abroad. And I think defense and homeland security have kind of taken a back seat to State Department as far as a lead agency, and certainly State Department and the setting of national policy and our diplomatic projections as well as our force projections are just as important. But I think now that we're going to see the different agencies working in concert with one another, and I don't know how foreign leaders perceived we, the United States, from a foreign policy perspective, because we really had none. I think it would be very difficult, unless you were the leader of Israel. It was pretty clear what America's policy was towards Israel, but we had such a wishy-washy policy without any backbone. We made hollow threats that we did not back up, which, you know, Obama was an enabler of aggression on a global scale. We've seen power projections from the Russians, from the Chinese, from pissant little dictatorships in third corners of the world that, you know, like Venezuela. And his lack of leadership enabled that type of behavior.
That's exactly right, Jamie. One of the things I've been talking about to a lot of groups, in fact, I was speaking at a group at lunch today. I did a compare and contrast to the things that the Obama administration and certainly our foreign policy as it pertained to Hillary Clinton, folks like us who have been around for years, they really weren't allowed to tell it like it is and provide the advice and guidance that they were there for. Everything was pretty much done on the seventh floor of the State Department or within the National Security Council at the White House. But one of the things that was missing that they didn't really understand is what I always describe when you go into a situation, and be it Syria or Libya or Egypt, in any of the areas where we've seen a failed national security and failed foreign policy with regard to the Obama administration, they didn't understand second, third, and fourth order effects of when you do something. And so they reacted they would respond or react to one issue, but they would not take into consideration, if I do this, what are the consequences of those actions? And they were extremely weak on that. And what we ended up with so many failed policies, it started with the Russian reset, and it went all the way on through to the Iran deal, and certainly everything in between throughout the Middle East. No one really looked at the long-term impact. They were looking for quick actions and things that they could throw up on the board as wins. And in fact, they really didn't get any at the beginning, and they ended up with worse situations in the end.
Yeah, the classic case in point, actually there's a whole litany of them, but our precipitous early withdrawal from both Afghanistan and Iraq, maybe even more so in Iraq, created that power void that, you know, this goes back to the 70s, the balance of power before we intervened in Iraq, you know, when the Iranians and the Iraqis were at war. There was a balance of power there. And then when the United States, and, you know, and this goes back to Bush's reign and his presidency, I'm not sure that they fully comprehended, they meaning both Bushes, the third and fourth orders of effect from our involvement during the first Gulf War and Iraqi freedom, and what the consequences of those actions would be. And then most certainly, as we withdrew American forces, it created a void in the power structure and created that vacuum, which those who were disenfranchised, it essentially gave birth to ISIS.
Absolutely. The other area was also Libya, and that's a classic failure to understand what was going on internally in Libya. Not to belabor the issue, but as you know, the initial reaction by the Obama administration with regard to Gaddafi was kind of a black and white scenario where they didn't look at the complexities going on the ground and internally in Libya. They automatically went from the assumption that Gaddafi was a bad guy, and certainly in the 70s and 80s he was. They didn't take into consideration that he was a power broker on behalf of the Soviet Union when the Soviet Union was in existence and the Cold War was flaring. The Soviets used him as an offshoot to the small wars around the world. The collapse of the Soviet Union ended his military support as Russia was struggling to find its way. And on the second point, Gaddafi was never a radical Islamist. He was a Arab nationalist, and was trying to be a power broker just like the other Middle Eastern nation leaders were at the time. And in the end, as Al-Qaeda came of shape and form in the late 90s, and he started realizing that Al-Qaeda was gunning for him, started to change his ways. Our intelligence community started talking and working with him, and in return for no longer hostilities against the U.S. and trying to mend his ways and reshape his legacy, started to provide us that. And then in walks Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, and automatically decided, well, he will be the first or one of the first players to go down as part of the Arab Spring. And then we saw a succession of that in Egypt with the removal of Hosni Mubarak, a longtime ally and stabilizing force in the region. And we saw Yemen go down. We saw what we saw in Syria with the Red Line. So it was really a matter of misunderstanding and failure to capitalize on many different aspects of foreign policy that were at play when Obama came in and ended up turning things into a worse scenario than was at play at the time.
Yeah, I never understood, unless there was motivations for either personal gain or showcasing, but you don't fix what's not broken. Gaddafi was already on board. I mean, right. There were demonstrable actions on his part that he were his bona fides, that he was playing ball with the United States. He got with our program until we changed the program.
Right, right.
And not to rehash the whole Benghazi thing, but, I mean, that was just a classic failure. And I look and I think, what if Hillary Clinton had continued the third term? God help us. It would have been disastrous.
That was in fact, that was one of the things I've been talking about with a number of people. Certainly with the Trump administration now, we kind of had an insight to who he was looking at to be his point people for national security. And I mentioned to some folks today and yesterday, I said, you know, we never got a glimpse into who she was looking at, whether she was going to keep the same team in place or maybe swap out a few. And, you know, the worst thing could have been that, you know, we could have ended up in a greater Middle Eastern war as a result of continued actions that she's doing, or she would have done, and what she was doing at the time, and certainly what Kerry continued with. And I guess in the end, it's we're better off. And I think from the standpoint of looking at the people that Mr. Trump is putting into play, he has really got some solid people there. I'm also really impressed with Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. From the standpoint, he knows the world. He's been involved in the world. He knows major players on the world forefront with regard to people in business and national security. And that's going to be, I think, a pivotal responsibility of his, and he will be able to do. It's not just knowing the diplomats in the world out there. It's knowing the major business players and the major money movers and makers in the world, because that's really what it comes to. That's one of the major pillars, and it's a major pillar of foreign policy. And that's certainly an area that I think we were lacking over the last 8 years.
Yeah, I would have to shake my head in disbelief when President Obama would talk about not having the A-team or refer to ISIS as the JV. And at the same time, he's got his deputy national security advisor is basically a failed fiction writer whose brother is president of one of the major news networks. It definitely was not the A-team as far as foreign policy and diplomacy, not for the past 8 years by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And it really, you know, it was twofold. One, that we had such failed foreign policy in practically every single area and everything that they touched, but we also are 8 years behind in where we could have been. I was still active duty, just as the Bush administration was going out, and you know, one of the things I remember, you know, we were looking at a forward strategy. We're looking at the global war on terror. We were looking at what we were identifying as a long war, mainly because it was ideological, and that's what radical Islam is. It's an ideology, and you know, we've fought multiple ideologies in the past. We fought Nazism and fascism in World War II. We went through the Cold War dealing with communism, and you know, it's more than just you know, shooting wars. It's that asymmetric aspect where, as I mentioned earlier, everything comes into play, from finance, economics, information, diplomacy, politics. There's so many avenues that have got to be orchestrated to come together, and you know, you need a good conductor who can make that work in a synergistic and a cooperative and collaborative form. I mean, that's it's going to be a huge effort. You know, for 8 years, people like yourself and myself and many other folks have been around. We continued to call for a strategic and coherent national security policy. And for 8 years of the Obama administration, we didn't get it.
You're listening to the America Out Loud Talk Radio Network. Well, it's where we say, let the silent voices be heard. You'll find a whole host of shows and a lineup of great content back at AmericaOutLoud.com.
We're going to have to look at a very aggressive energy policy that, you know, and Perry, I think, is a capable guy. He's got executive experience with one of the largest states and an oil-producing state. But we've got to move towards this energy independence.
Exactly.
I think for generations, we've been so tied to the Middle East, and we have such vast resources. And maybe today, we saw the first steps of unlocking some of those resources. I listened to President Trump say, you know, that he considered himself a bit of an environmentalist, and it's all a matter of applying equanimity. You don't ruin the environment at the expense of progress and capitalism and being able to drive our big SUVs. But on the other hand, you don't stifle productivity and energy independency on account of the red-headed woodpecker and the, you know, East Bejesus box turtle. That, I mean, we saw this in the military, where we'd have to basically cease operations while, you know, animals were studied and their habitats analyzed. And I get all that. I get all that, and I'm not insensitive to it. But you reach a tipping point, and the EPA holds an important part of preserving a lot of what we have, but at the same time, it has to be weighed with progress.
People like Governor Perry and again, Rex Tillerson, certainly working together on that effort for energy independence. And it's energy independence for America. And what people have to understand, it's not to destroy the economies of countries like Saudi Arabia, the energy producing countries in the Middle East, or Russia, who is also a major energy producer. It's about providing our own security and our own independence so that we don't have to rely on those countries and those regions of the world for our energy into the future. We don't want to collapse those economies either, because that only creates other problems. So there's going to be certainly a lot of behind the scenes diplomatic business efforts to make sure that they stay afloat, not because of anything from a militaristic or national security standpoint, but from the standpoint of regional stability. And I think a lot of those countries know that. I know a number of the Gulf states are looking at other areas to carry them through the future, from technology and being IT centers and financial banking centers, mm-hmm. trade centers, transportation hubs. They're looking for alternatives for their economic and business viabilities, and that's certainly something we want to be attuned to and want to be part of when it comes to our business and diplomatic things. So I think we're looking at some good people who will be able to handle that.
And maybe it's time that our nation gets run like a business rather than governed by political nepotism and political appointments based on favors rather than pure skill and acumen in the business and diplomatic arena. So I think Tillerson, I mean, certainly he would have been a good choice for any number of positions to include energy. He certainly has that background, but he does have the contacts. And, you know, none of these things alone are going to solve the problem. They have to be applied synergistically, as you mentioned. Whereas, you know, at the same time we move towards energy independence, we also have to reduce the national debt. And how do you do that when the infrastructure is crumbling? And that presents certain vulnerabilities, you know, anything from EMP, the electromagnetic pulse vulnerability, to nature and gravity, collapsing structures and bridges and highways that you know, were built in the 50s and, you know, or... And maybe it's instituting programs such as the WPA programs from Roosevelt's era and the Civilian Conservation Corps and similar type programs to rebuild the infrastructure. At the same time, you're getting people employed, may not be a career choice, but it beats being on the dole, on the taxpayer dime. And I think President Trump, as a businessman, as somebody who's had plenty of success in that arena, may be the guy to pull all this together and have that synergy where we can accomplish, which appear maybe at face value to be conflicting priorities. It's not going to be an easy thing to orchestrate by any means.
Definitely, it's going to take someone with that strategic vision. Certainly Donald Trump has that from being a businessman for 40 years or so or more, and it will take a team that recognizes and understands that. And so now we're in the process of building that team. Yeah, there's going to be a major paradigm shift in how we go about how we move through what the Trump administration wants to do with regard to rebuilding the country. It's going to require that shift from getting away from government being the implementer, and rather government being the orchestrator and bringing on business to meet those challenges. I think that's what we're seeing in the last couple of days, where we've seen President Trump meet with the IT Silicon Valley CEOs, the major auto manufacturer CEOs yesterday, the labor unions. He's bringing in those that are going to have a somewhat of a strategic role in doing the kind of work that he wants done. And so I think he's setting the stage for that paradigm shift where government shrinks, so to speak, and tasks, certainly it'll be through contracts and things like that, but let private industries come up with solutions and ways to solve problems. Business is always more effective because they're working on a bottom line, and if government can work off that same ideology, so to speak, of living in government and living within its means, I think it's a win-win for everyone.
And just the fact that the union labor leaders sat down with the president, with this president, with a Republican administration, in a cooperative effort to take that industrial base that is a huge strength of the United States, or was at one time, and I think it can be again. And there's going to be some pain. There's going to be some pain. There was already some pain at the polls. But this false sense of security that the government is responsible for your life. I want the government to provide for my basic rights. I want the government to provide for my general safety and security. And okay, yeah, it's nice to have an EBT card, and it's nice to have a free cell phone, but that's a special kind of slavery. That's a special kind of hell that the government imposed on a particular segment of our society, primarily the blacks. It's more economic, but predominantly it's the African Americans that have suffered from that. And I think if the unions, if the administration, Trump's reached out, not just, putting Carson in at Health and Social Services, but reaching out to community leaders within some of the major municipalities. You've got celebrities and sports figures and people who have leadership roles within the African American community to try to turn this thing around. There's so much racial divide. There's so much economic separation, and this antipathy towards law enforcement community that we've never seen since you and I were little boys in the 60s.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. I really see our former president as really being an instigator for division. Because when you look back at even the early 2000s, up until 2009, we didn't see any degree of what we've seen in the last 8 years, in particular the last 4 years. And I'll also say I think it had a significant impact on where we were going with regard to Islam and how we approached it. again, going back to when I was active duty, and I spent pretty much my last 8 years traveling around the Middle East an awful lot, even you know, particularly from the post 9/11 period, and certainly other than Afghanistan and Iraq, where we had two wars raging there, and you couldn't travel certainly on your own anywhere. But in the rest of the Middle East, Central Asia, Horn of Africa, and North Africa, where I traveled a lot by myself, or just with one or two other people. Never had a problem anywhere. Certainly, people recognized me as an American. Middle Easterners, Arabs, be it Sunni and Shia, never had a problem with them. They never showed any hostility to me. I'd go out to dinner with them. I'd meet them in different venues. Was always welcome. Always had an invitation for different kinds of venues, and certainly in my travels after I got out of the military, but still going back to the Middle East and in business dealings, the whole you could almost feel it in the air. You didn't dare go anywhere by yourself. You didn't talk to a lot of people in our dealings with those other than who were really close allies had really changed. And so I think that aura and that mindset has multiplied over the years.
And I still am, I have a lot of employees, former employees that were of Middle East origin, because we hired a lot of them as intelligence
right.
analysts, interpreters, what have you. They're American citizens. You know, they have some real fears. Now, whether these are real or perceived, they're real to them. And I think a lot of it is hype. But I sympathize with them. And I think things get, you know, the message gets lost because people either deliberately fail to make a distinction between Islam and radical Islam. You know, nobody's talking about rounding up Muslim Americans and putting them on the train and sending them to the camps. That was never part of the consideration. And I think the media has a lot to do with hyping that as much as the media and the progressive left have a lot to do with a lot of things of how it's perceived in this country. But at the same time, they deluded half of the country into thinking that Hillary Clinton's birthright was to become president of the United States. And the Democratic Party and the supporters were all lulled into this false sense of security. And I think the media played a huge role in that. But the irony would be, here's the guy who's been called a racist and a misogynist and a hater. Here's a guy, after 8 years of an African-American president, that may in time, given a chance, actually turn things around between the African-American community and the police and bringing employment and prosperity and security into some of these neighborhoods and essentially, you know, accomplishing a lot of things at the same time. And I thought, let's just give him a chance. I mean, I wasn't real happy about the election of Barack Obama, either of them. But at the end of the day, after the votes were counted, he was my president, whether I liked it or not. And I didn't. But I didn't talk about blowing up the White House. And here, this is another thing. I just saw his parting shot was to give $221 million to the Palestinian Authority after funding the Iranians. That was his last middle finger to the United States before leaving office. But talk about the security to the United States. The other thing is the hidden agenda of the progressive left And that's, you know, it's not a conspiracy theory. It's actually happening, whether it's Soros funded. There's no doubt in my mind that Russia intervened in our elections, not to the point of changing votes in the machine and electing Donald Trump. But there's no doubt in my mind that to some degree or another, the Russians had a role in that. To be fair, CNN had a role in it. MSNBC had a role in it. It's just another type of propaganda. But Americans need to open their eyes and be cognizant of forces that are working against the interests of the United States. And a lot of them are tied to the unions. A lot of them are tied to the progressive left and the education or re-education of America's youth that over time will govern our future. So we were at a critical point in our history and progress as a free nation. And that may sound like a lot of hyperbole, and I'm sure it will to some people on the left, but I truly believe that we were at a crossroad.
Exactly. And interesting that you mentioned the influence or the perceived influence that the mainstream media put out there on the election and who was involved. Certainly, our own mainstream media, be it the major networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, MSNBC, PBS, and the mainstream liberal print media, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Washington Post, New York Times, Chicago Tribune, and all the rest had a far greater influence on people in general in America, and certainly drove more people's opinions in their decision at the polls than anything the Russians did. At the same time, I've did a lot of research in the last month on Russia's involvement from what I could find, and my conclusion actually and I've got several articles out there on it, and they're on America Out Loud, that those within the Trump campaign and Trump himself, there was no influence on their behalf with Russia to influence the election in his favor. This was really a strategic psyop campaign on the part of the Democratic Party and the Clinton machine to tie Trump to the Russians because present that as a bad thing, so that people would vote for Hillary, not vote for Donald Trump. It was really pushed by the media that, you know, and it continues to be pushed by the media that Trump won the election because of his ties to Russia, which is, you know, probably one of the biggest false narratives of this whole 2016 election campaign.
This was their own undoing, the incestuous relationship between the Clinton campaign and the mainstream media and Donna Brazile handing questions over. I had to laugh because, like I said, it lulled everybody into this false perception, and nobody saw the movement that was taking place. I didn't even see it. I saw it to a degree. But I was even surprised. I mean, as I travel around the country, you get a sense, and it's there's no measurable, definitive metrics, but you get a sense of seeing bumper stickers and road signs. And, you know, I've gotten into arguments with friends lately about this whole Women's March. I'm all about empowering women, and I'm all about women's rights, but let's be honest. You know, if it was truly a woman's march, it was just an anti-Trump, anti-establishment, workers, socialists, progressives unite, and we'll call it a woman's march.
Yeah, exactly. It was portrayed as that. I read a piece last night or this morning that talked all about this was all orchestrated as by the Democratic Party, various far left organizations, the Clinton campaign put the face on it as a women's march, but it's really a march, an anti-Trump march. It was planned for the day after the inauguration. You get positive spin by labeling it a women's march, but when they did that, you know, what came out to participate were the most extreme radical women, feminists, whatever you want to label them as, that really showed their face, and it really turned off a lot of women. It turned off a lot of women. I was talking with some women at dinner last night, and then I asked, "Well, what did you think of the women's march?" And a lot of these women weren't, you know, conservative or Republican, and they basically said they were embarrassed that these people represented themselves as representatives of women across America. If it was representatives of women across America, why wouldn't you invite all women, regardless of their politics?
Right.
I didn't see any conservative women. I didn't see any moderate, apolitical women who don't want anything to do with politics there.
No.
It was the as far left as you can get, rabid, radical, and just obscene people you could ever find.
Pro-Trump, you were unwelcome. Pro-life,
yeah.
Unwelcome. It wasn't about women. It was about their own agenda. And I told friends of mine, I said, you were duped. You were used. Oh, don't judge. You weren't there. I didn't have to be there. Didn't have to be there. And, you know, there was a great picture of this gay couple, two women. It says, we're lesbians. We're not stupid. And it said, you know, we voted for Trump, we're gay, but we're not stupid. Mm-hmm. And of course, they were shunned by, you know, oh yeah, you're gay, great. Oh, you voted for Trump? Oh, sorry, not welcome. So it really wasn't about women. And I feel sorry for the women that went there and thought, you know, if you were truly there for women's rights and the empowerment of women, God, I've been led by women at times. My superiors, I've led women, some even in combat. I have two sisters, a daughter, a granddaughter. I'm all about empowering women, but this wasn't the way to do it. That whole thing, in my opinion, did women a great disservice. And if a man had done that, it would have been sexist and misogynist. The fact that these women were doing it just made it even more hypocritical and more disgusting.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was agenda driven. And if you weren't within that agenda, they weren't tolerant to hear any other side. End of story. It was a political prop. And unfortunately, as you said, a lot of people, men and women, because there were a number of men that I saw in a lot of the clips from TV and on the internet who were involved, and I think a lot of them were probably duped.
Well, I heard that there were 40% were men, and
right.
You know, that's great that men are supporting women. I just wonder how many of that 40%, if that's accurate. How many were there truly supporting women, or how many of them were there out of anti-establishment, anti-authority, anti-Trump, or just didn't know why were there? They just wanted an excuse to break bad in public.
Right.
And so many of these people are your professional agitators, whether they're funded by George Soros or SEIU or take your pick. That's when I talk about the hidden agenda of the progressive left. They won't come out and say, we are the Communist Party. You know, they'll talk about comrades and workers in private, but it's the Communist Party. You can put a different label on it. There's an interesting, I guess it's a documentary. It's called America Under Siege, Civil War 2017. Not an endorsement, just something that probably bears investigation. I just received, I guess it's the video trailer. I haven't even looked at it thoroughly. I just kind of rushed through it, but it typifies some of the things that we were just discussing as far as this underground movement, which basically foments insurrection, which we've seen right. a lot of in the past, particularly in the past 4 years of the previous administration. But you know, this all together ties what effect, and we didn't even get in. We're running up against the end of our hour, and we didn't even discuss the rebuilding of the intelligence community and the military. But maybe that's the whole strength through superior firepower is just kind of an understood given that after 8 years of the Obama administration, we've trimmed the fat, we've trimmed the muscle, and we've cut into the bone. You know, the fact that people turn up at these different rallies, whether it be to protest a pipeline or occupy Wall Street, and you know, there's signs that are pre-made and arrangements for transportation and billeting have been made. That just doesn't spontaneously come together any more than this Women's March did. So it takes a lot of money, and he's got it.
Right, exactly. I think first and foremost, one of the big responsibilities of President Trump and the new administration is the rebuilding and resetting of our military. We've been going at it a long time, and unfortunately, not a lot done from the standpoint of the Obama administration to rest, refit, and rebuild our military. So we're far behind that in weapon systems and just rebuilding and reestablishing our military to do the missions it was designed to do, certainly get away from the social experimentation and social engineering that certainly had I tend to believe in talking with a lot of people. A lot of wasted time and effort focused on that, where commanders and senior leaders should have been focusing on threats and rebuilding our military.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a major effort that we need to see come to an end, and we really need to do a lot. We need to get away from some of the ridiculous policies that are really plaguing our men and women in uniform. There's a lot of resetting the barometer and reestablishing our real missions in order to be successful in our future endeavors. And certainly we will be called upon, the military will be called upon, as it always has, to do a lot of work despite a new administration in there who has a totally different strategic approach to the world.
And hopefully we can be proactive and do it voluntarily rather than in extremist, reactionary, post-Pearl Harbor type.
Right.
Well, Jim, thank you so much. I always enjoy your insights. We did mention that you were on the White House staff and you have unique insights into government and intelligence. Always a pleasure, my friend. Wish you the best.
great talking with you, Jamie, and look forward to having a discussion again in the future.
Likewise. Talk soon. Thank you.